Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. In the summer of 1993, an upstate New York community was rocked to its core when 12-year-old Sarah Ann Wood went missing. Sarah's abduction inspired the community and the public and law enforcement to raise awareness about child safety and missing children. This is the story of Sarah Ann Wood, episode 52.
From the very beginning, the one thing that we can tell ourselves that what happened out of this horrible situation was that so many people learned from it, and just us from the next day all the way on to 22 years later. You have families that are teaching their children. You have adults that are becoming more educated in how to teach their children. And I think that is Sarah's legacy right now.
You just heard Andrea McDiarmid, a classmate of Sarah Ann Wood, speaking to News Channel 2 22 years after the disappearance of Sarah Ann. It has now been 31 years since Sarah Ann disappeared, and being a member of an upstate New York community myself, this is something that I want to try to keep in the public eye. Sarah Ann Wood needs to come home to her family. I would like to try to keep this story geared more towards Sarah Ann, her family, and her community. On the afternoon of August 18th, 1993, Dusty Wood was standing at the front door of his family home with his 12-year-old sister, Sarah Ann. Sarah was an extroverted, intelligent young lady who loved to dance and sing, and today she was singing one of her favorite songs by her favorite artist, Dolly Parton. She was standing at that door singing 9 to 5. Dusty lovingly laughed at his little sister as she left their home on her bicycle, headed towards Norwich Corners Church. This is where their father worked as a preacher. The church was holding a vacation Bible school. During the summer months, Sarah would head over that way and help out with the program. Dusty would say of his little sister, she was an exuberant person. She was excited to be alive. Every picture you see of her, it's like a big beaming smile, those bright blue eyes. This would be the last time that Dusty Wood ever saw his little sister, Sarah Ann. Hours later, Dusty was at a friend's house hanging out when he got a phone call from his parents saying, Sarah Ann is missing. The search for Sarah Ann would become one of the largest at that time in 1993. Sarah was last seen at approximately 2:30 p.m. on August 18, 1993, riding her pink and white bicycle up a steep hill on Hackadam Road. This was in Frankfort, New York. At the time of Sarah Ann's disappearance, she was wearing a pink t-shirt with the words Guess Who embroidered on the front. She had on turquoise blue shorts and brown sandals, and she was also wearing her glasses. Sarah's family acted quickly, and within an hour of noticing her missing, they had already begun their own search. Police would be called that afternoon, and the search for Sarah Ann would be swift. Several hundred police and firefighters joined forces and searched far and wide nonstop. Bob Woods' church became the headquarters in their frantic search for his 12-year-old daughter. Within hours, a neighbor would spot Sarah's pink and white bike leaning against a tree several yards from the street that she was last spotted on. Searching that area further would soon reveal Sarah Ann's coloring book and crayons hidden in a bush. Brother Dusty Wood spoke to 48 Hours' Aaron Moriarty. He said, "We'd be out in the woods searching for her at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, hoping that we find her in maybe a hole or maybe she fell down in something." Sarah Ann's father, Bob Wood, would say in 1993, "The first day was the worst. The first night, of course, you know, I was up on the road all night, out in the woods all night." Dusty would say, "Our entire family was focused on getting Sarah back. So if you want to investigate me, I'm okay with that. Sarah has got to come home. We will do whatever it takes, period." Once Sarah's family was cleared, detectives turned their attention to known and suspected sex offenders within the community. There was extensive news coverage of her disappearance throughout much of upstate New York. More than 1,000 leads were received, and a public reward for Sarah's safe return reached over $150,000. I remember this news coverage so vividly. Having grown up so close to where Sarah Ann lived, I was around 16 years old at the time of her abduction, and that one photo of Sarah Ann that has been circulated around upstate New York since 1993 will forever be in my mind. As Sarah's dad, Bob, said to the New York Times in 1993, "Sarah has captivated people to the point where they've adopted her. They want her back too." Ed Grove, a Utica businessman and volunteer director of the Rescue Center and a longtime friend of the Wood family, harnessed the power of volunteers and communications to get the word out about Sarah's disappearance. He said, "In a week's time, we have 1,500,000 flyers. We now have flyers in every state and Canada and several countries. We've hit Italy, France, Germany, Korea, and Japan." Sarah's picture was everywhere. The word was out. But despite the efforts of the entire community, it wasn't going to be until 5 months later, after Sarah's disappearance, in January 1994, that detectives were going to get another lead. And this lead was going to break this case wide open. On January 7th, 1994, at 7:10 a.m., in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, 12-year-old Becky Savarese was on her way to school. She was walking along a really busy intersection, and she was listening to her Walkman. She was actually listening to the Smashing Pumpkins. Walking, she says that a man stopped her. He came up beside her, and Becky says that this man, he had a mustache, but he didn't shave. He seemed like a nerd to me. Becky says that this guy pulled out a gun and he held it up against her. She said that the gunman threatened her. He said, "Just do everything I say. Everything will be perfectly okay." Then he steered her towards his truck and he told her to get in, but Becky said no. Becky said to 48 Hours, "I didn't care if he shot me. I just knew I was not going to get into that truck." Becky must have been watching Oprah, just like I was at that time, because you were always told, never go to the second location. Easier said than done until you're put in that situation, but for Becky, she was not getting in that truck. Becky says that very quickly, she decides she's going to fake an asthma attack. She doesn't even have asthma. She just says that she said to her attacker, "Can I sit down? Can I just sit down for a minute?" And she says that he was trying to take her backpack off this entire time. He kept trying to grab her. And finally, he grabbed her backpack and she just lifted her arms up, let the backpack fall off of her, and she just started to run. This guy was not looking to cause a scene, so instead he just jumps back in his truck and he speeds away. Becky is running and she sees a man that is clearing his driveway of the snow. She runs up to him and this man calls the police for her. And luckily, at the same time, there was a witness who got 3 digits from the truck's license plate. Police figure out who this truck belongs to. They arrive at the home of the owner of this truck. Police ask if this is your truck, and the guy says, yes, it is my truck, but I wasn't driving it today. I let a friend borrow it all morning. And another stroke of luck for the police, that friend was sitting right in this guy's kitchen at that very moment. He tells them, I let my friend Lewis drive this truck today, and he's right here. Do you want to talk to him? Police enter this home and they go to talk to Lewis Lent. He denies that he knows anything about a girl named Becky, but he did agree that he would go down to the police station for some more questioning. Before heading down to the police station, detectives are now going to search the vehicle that Becky said this man was driving. And inside of that vehicle, they find duct tape, a knife, a gun, a pair of child's sunglasses, and candy. And you know what else they find? They find Becky Savarese's backpack and a loaded gun. Police would now also search Lewis Lent's Lanesboro home, and what they find inside of that home is horrifying. They find a private chamber that's in the process of being under construction. Now, this chamber is very intricate, and it is underneath his house. Lent is going to confess that he was constructing this chamber for the sole purpose of restraining and abusing his victims. During an interrogation, Lewis Lent would elaborate that his ideal victim would be between the age of 12 and 17, with long hair and, quote, just beginning to develop physically, and someone that he could, quote, take out from this area of confinement whenever he desired to sexually abuse them. So you might be asking, what does this have to do with Sarah Ann Wood? Less than 12 hours after Becky's attempted kidnapping, New York State Detective Frank Lawrence drove through a snowstorm to get to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which would only be a little less than a three-hour drive. He was on his way to question Lewis Lent about Sarah Ann's disappearance. The circumstances of Becky's attempted abduction and the victim profile closely matched Sarah Ann's abduction. Detective Frank Lawrence is going to sit down with Lewis Lent, and he is going to show him a photo of Sarah Ann and tell him, this is who I am here to talk about. Do you remember Sarah Ann? And Lewis is going to completely deny that he ever saw or met Sarah Ann Wood. And this is going to be an ongoing theme for detectives throughout this case. What we're going to learn about Lewis Lent is that he's a flip-flopper. He is always telling you one thing and then changing his mind and telling you, never mind. This is what led to many detectives to believe that Lewis Lent might have multiple personality disorder. But who is Lewis Lent Jr.? For most of his life, Lewis Lent Jr. led a quiet, directionless life. He held a job as a movie theater attendant for 7 years. He was aimless, but upbeat and friendly. Lewis Lent Jr. would prove to be quite a dichotomy to his friends and his family. He was known as Louie. According to the New York Times, he liked to talk about cars and claimed an expertise in repairing them. But then the cars that he owned would be pieces of junk that he would ask his friends to repair. He would talk incessantly about horticulture to his movie theater manager, but then he wasn't ever able to follow simple instructions regarding cleaning compounds that should never be mixed. His manager said that they actually had to hide the cleaning products in the movie theater in fear that Lent is going to misuse them or cause some harm. He did not trust Lewis Lent's ability to follow even simple rules and instructions. Lewis Lent would often visit a nonprofit assistance agency in his town where he lived, and the New York Times interviewed his case manager named Lisa Rondeau. She would say that he was different. He was goofy. There was just something about him, very, very nice. He just wanted to help everybody, she would say. She said that his flannel shirts and jeans and his good cheer made him something of a comic figure. He wasn't violent and he wasn't aggressive. Louis Lent was born and raised in upstate New York in the hamlet of Reynoldsville in Schuyler County. He dropped out of Watkins Glen High School in 1967 when he was only in the 10th grade. And soon after dropping out, he would move to Florida. He would stay there until 1983. And then sometime in the 80s, Louis would return to the Northeast to live. And that is when he would settle in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It is noted that Louis would flutter through jobs. And as I said earlier, he was just confusing to his neighbors because on one hand, he would ask if he could help shovel your driveway and be a super cool neighbor. And then the next thing you know, as Stephen Nichols found out, this is one of Louis's neighbors, he said that one day Louis just showed up at his house with a bat, threatening to kill his dog. Stephen Nichols tells police that Louis would say, "Please restrain your dog. I do have a gun, and if I have to use it, I will." So neighbors are seeing two different sides to Louis Lent. Some neighbors are saying, "He's great. He's awesome. He would come over to my house and help me build things around my house that needed to get done, and he would do it for free." Some people are saying that when he was working at the movie theater, he was known to the children as the nice guy that worked at the movie theater. He would let some kids come in free, watch movies for free. It was even said that he would hold movie nights for the kids in town, where after the theater closed, he would set up like a tent or have a sleepover party and play movies for the kids in town. And now that detail is going to bring me to Jimmy Bernardo. This case gets a little complicated in the fact that now that Louis is in custody, he is going to now be interrogated about numerous child abductions, child murders that have been happening all throughout these towns. Police now have Louis Lent sitting in their police station and they are ready to interrogate him not only about what he just did to Becky Savarese, but also to the disappearance of Sarah Ann Wood and the murder of 12-year-old Jimmy Bernardo of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. In October 22, 1990, Jimmy Bernardo was a 12-year-old boy who had gone missing. A month after he went missing, hunters would find his body. Now, this case had stumped the local investigators for years. But now that Lent is ready to talk, everyone wants to know if he had something to do with Jimmy Bernardo. Jimmy Bernardo's body was found on November 21st, 1990. And on February 14th, 1994, Louis Lent is going to be indicted for the murder of Jimmy Bernardo. He will talk, and this is what he tells police. Louis is going to say that he met Jimmy at the movie theater while he was working there. He worked there as a janitor, and he said that he actually offered Jimmy $5 to come inside of the movie theater and help him clean up, help him move the chairs around. And Jimmy was like, "Okay, sure." Jimmy goes inside of the theater, and this is when Louis Lent is going to take Jimmy's hands and tie them behind his back at knife point. Louis Lent is going to admit that he did put Jimmy Bernardo into his truck and he drove him back to his own home. This is where he was going to tie Jimmy to his bed by his wrist and his ankles. He had Jimmy in his home until the next morning, and this is when he's going to blindfold Jimmy and then drive him to Newfield, New York, into a wooded area, and this is where he's going to strangle Jimmy to death with rope. The duct tape that was placed over Jimmy's mouth and across his eyes is going to be a match to the same duct tape that is found in Louis Lent's vehicle at the time that he was arrested for the abduction of Becky Savarese. So first, back to Becky Savarese. At this point, it is January 13th, 1995, and Louis Lent is going to be sentenced to serve a term of between 17 and 20 years for the attempted abduction of Becky Savarese. So now police have Lewis Lent locked up, but they are still going to go after Jimmy Bernardo. They want more information on Sarah Wood, and they are going to discover that there are other children that might be associated to Lewis Lent. We are now back to January 1994, where Detective Frank Lawrence is in the interrogation room with Lewis Lent. And this is when Lewis Lent is going to confess to encountering Sarah while she was walking alongside her bicycle on that Hackadam Road. He would say that he would drag Sarah into his van at knife point. He bound her hands and he drove her to the Adirondack Mountains, where he sexually assaulted Sarah. Lent would go on to say that he bludgeoned Sarah with a tree branch. He then buried her body in a grave near Racket Lake. Lewis Lent is now going to draw a map of the location of Sarah's burial site, and this is to help the investigators to recover her body. A statewide search is now upon the New York Adirondack Mountains, and it is blistering cold. There are 50 days of tedious searching through this deep snow, and finally, authorities had to stop their effort. Over 100 state troopers, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation Police, numerous volunteers, and 50 personnel from Griffiths Air Force Base all helped in this effort to help find Sarah's body. The entire community came together. And to further inflict pain upon this family, Lewis Lent now says, "Never mind, I didn't really bury Sarah near Racket Lake. I'm not going to tell you where she's actually buried because I buried someone else next to her, and I don't want to be in trouble for that murder." The amount of restraint it must have taken these detectives to not just clock him in his face as he is standing in front of them. Detectives will get used to Lewis Lent recanting his confessions over and over. They do not know what to believe anymore. So we are now into the year 1996, and it is June 3rd, 1996. This is when Lewis Lent is going to plead guilty to killing Jimmy Bernardo. And on October 16th, 1996, Lewis Lent is going to be found guilty for the murder of Jimmy Bernardo, and he is going to be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And at his sentencing, he is going to tell his attorney that he would also like to plead guilty to Sarah Ann Wood's murder. But Lewis Lent is now going to go back on his word with that one also. And he will say that it is because he sees Sarah's family in the courtroom and he can't do it. He can't face them. And he cannot admit that he killed their daughter, their sister. So, 9 days later, on October 25th, 1996, Lewis Lent is going to plead guilty this time to Sarah Ann's abduction, rape, and murder. And even though her parents chose not to come to the courtroom for this sentencing, he did refuse to still provide any information on where Sarah is. Lent's confession is now being recanted again. He is now going to say he didn't do it, changed his mind. Doesn't matter, because on April 11th, 1997, they are going to now sentence Lewis Lent for the murder and abduction of Sarah Ann Wood. This judge, he is going to sentence Lewis to a concurrent term of 25 years to life in prison. And this sentencing, it was actually delayed 2 months because Sarah's parents were trying to persuade Lewis Lent to give them more information on where their daughter was. The judge even tried to persuade Lewis, and he said no. He doesn't care. He's not telling anybody anything. Lewis Lent was even offered a deal where he wouldn't have to serve out his life sentence in a state prison if he did reveal where Sarah's body was, but he said no. He refused pleas from Sarah's parents, from Sarah's brother. He wasn't going to give up anything. So for Lewis Lent, after now being in jail since 1994, he's convicted on kidnapping, abduction, murder of three different children. It is now 2013, and Lewis Lent is going to confess again to another murder of a 16-year-old named James Donald Lusher. James was a mentally disabled teenager who disappeared while riding his bike to his grandmother's house. And Lewis Lent agreed to confess to this murder, but it was only in exchange for him not being prosecuted. So Lewis Lent is going to confess that he abducted James Lusher close to Westfield, Massachusetts. And then he says that he discarded James' body in a town called Beckett. Now, similar to Sarah Ann Wood, James' bike was found, but his body has never been recovered. After the confession of killing Jamie Lusher, police are going to hold a press conference, and investigators will search Greenwater Pond in Beckett, Massachusetts, and this is where Lent told them that he disposed of Jamie's body. But this search effort was also going to be unsuccessful. And on top of that, Lewis Lent is now going to recant this confession. I do just want to mention that Lewis Lent was also considered a suspect in another 1986 disappearance. This 13-year-old girl was named Tammy Ann McCormick. She was a Saratoga Springs junior high school student. Tammy told her sister that she was just going to hitchhike to school this morning, but Tammy never arrived at the school. There were some suspicions that it could have been possible that Tammy hitchhiked to Florida, but she didn't bring one personal belonging. So foul play is suspected in this case. Lewis Lent never confessed to any crime with Tammy Ann McCormick, but he was considered a suspect. There was also another suspect named Arthur Mason Slaybaugh. Herkimer County District Attorney Jeffrey Carpenter said, "In July of 2013, we actually brought Lewis Lent back to New York in hopes that he would help lead us to Sarah. That attempt was not successful, and to this day, Lent still plays a cat-and-mouse game with law enforcement regarding the location of Sarah Ann Wood's remains." Jeffrey Carpenter would say, "Every time we go to see him, we learn more. You sit with him, and it's like talking to the devil himself." I don't want to talk about Lewis Lent anymore, and I know that you don't want to listen to it, so let's try and end this on a positive note. According to the Utica Observer-Dispatch, Dusty Wood is focused now on spreading awareness of child abduction. He says, "The most important thing for us as a family is to protect kids and make sure that if there's anything that can be done to protect them from monsters like Lewis Lent, that it is going to be done." National Missing Children's Day is May 25th, and on May 25th, 1995, Bob and Dusty Wood would ride their bikes 600 miles from upstate New York to Washington, D.C., and this was to raise money and to, most importantly, raise awareness for missing children and abduction prevention. This ride still continues every year to this day. These rides are known as the Ride for Missing Children, which honor the ongoing commitments of the Sarah Ann Wood Rescue Center and law enforcement to raise awareness of the plight of missing children. All funds raised are given to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and each annual bike ride sees thousands of attendees. Each participant on this bike ride will wear a jersey of Sarah's favorite colors of teal and pink, with additional colors of white, and that color represents all missing children nationwide. They also wear the color purple, and this is as a tribute to law enforcement. On their trek, the riders will stop at local schools to go inside and speak to the children about safety awareness. I think that is spectacular. Sarah's family founded the Sarah Ann Wood Rescue Center, which later became the Mohawk Valley branch of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The facility is located in Utica, New York, and they specialize in the preparation and distribution of missing child posters. And it remains the only geographically targeted missing child poster distribution center in the United States. What an absolutely inspirational family. Building community is such a beautiful and therapeutic way to get through something horrific. And I wanted to leave you with something that one of the volunteers working at the rescue center said. Now, this was 12-year-old Laura McCarthy. She was a friend of Sarah's. And she said, "Volunteering takes your mind off of things that you don't want to think about. It makes you want to keep on hoping." Thank you so much for joining me again this week on Residue. You know how much I appreciate all of your support. You guys are the best. I do want to say that the Major Crimes Unit at the State Police Office in Oneida is still accepting leads and any information from potential witnesses in the Sarah Ann Wood case. They can be reached at 315-366-6000. If there is anybody that has any information at all, even if they think that it might be inconsequential, we would still like to know about it. We would encourage anybody that has any insight that they think we should follow up on to give us a call. If you enjoyed Residue, please share with your friends and family. Please leave reviews. Please share on social media. And don't forget to hit that follow button. Until next time, you guys, stay safe and stay paranoid.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.